The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Today we're going to have a talk about race in the media and a whole range of ways to thinking about that subject. And joining me here in the studio in Campbell Hall, we've got two terrific guests. David Roediger, the professor, the Kendrick Babcock Chair of History at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, one of our most noted faculty members, has written several books, including The Wages of Whiteness, Race and the Making of the American Working Class, and Towards the Abolition of Whiteness. Joining us also is Sundiata Chajwa, the director of the Afro-American Studies Department, or Studies and Research Program, is that correct? Excuse me, here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, as well as an associate professor of history, the author of America's First Black Town, Brooklyn, Illinois, 1830 to 1915, published by the University of Illinois Press in 2000. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me today on Media Matters.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Well, first of all, Dave Roediger, before we get into the heart of the matter, let's just talk a little bit. Your work has been about whiteness, and it's a term that I think it's been in vogue in academic circles now for several years. But I think to a lot of our listeners, it's a term that they're not really quite familiar with how it's used in academic terms or scholarly terms. What is the study of whiteness about? Where is that, and what do you say about it?
Yeah. Well, the study of whiteness, I think, it comes out of African-American studies. I was trained in African-American studies, and my appointment is half in African-American studies now. And in the last 15 years or so, since the Reagan administration and massive white worker voting for conservative Republicans, people have gone back to African-American literature and history to think about why it is that people identify so strongly as white, so that why are there white workers? Why are there white artists? And when there are white workers, why does the accent fall on white rather than worker very often? So the business of critical study of whiteness is to make whiteness a problem, a historical problem, a moral problem, a sociological, political. And so for whom has whiteness been a problem historically mm-hmm. in the United States? It's been for people of color. So it's very much a body of scholarship that grows out of ethnic studies and I think now is locating itself within ethnic studies programs. And it asks, you know, when and why did people become white?
Yeah, let me ask sure. you that then. When and why did people become white?
Well, I think that Du Bois says the idea of personal whiteness, that is owning one's own whiteness, is a very recent concept in human history, not more than 250 years old. He writes this in about 1930, I think. So clearly, you go back and you're talking about settler colonialism and you're talking about the slave trade. And the justification for those two projects is very much part of when people invent the term white, begin to think of themselves as white. My own work is more about when did workers become white. And I place that in the United States in the early 19th century as in the context of industrialization occurring alongside slavery. People say, well, how are we different from slaves? What makes us free white workers? And so whiteness becomes a very firm identity for workers at that point, I think.
So if I follow this, in one hand, outside of historical matters, one of the importance of the ideas of whiteness is that people – the dominant culture tends to assume white is the norm, it's a natural, and everything else is sort of right. veers away from it. And this says, no, that's not true. Whiteness is no more the norm than anything else. Mm. But also historically plays a very important role historically in the way our historical development is. It's not simply a symbolic or rhetorical issue, but it goes right to the heart of how politics have evolved in this country.
Yeah. I mean, I think the history of whiteness is part of the history of capitalism, and it's very much a central issue, not just in race relations, but in how we look at history in general.
Yeah, the history of capitalism. Now, some of our listeners are probably saying, oh, capitalism, that's like investors and making profits. What does that have to do with whiteness?
Well, I mean, the origins of capitalism very much lie in the slave trade, and the origins of white workerism very much lie in proletarianization and trying to come to grips with all of these losses of freedom that are tied up with being a wage worker, maybe being a factory worker by the later part of the 19th century. So I think it's very much about it's embedded within these broader processes.
Sindhiata Cha-Jua, the director of the Afro-American Studies and Research Program here at the University of Illinois. Your work is your first book, I think it's your first book, on America's First Black Town, Brooklyn, Illinois. Deals with a black community, the first?
It's actually the first African-American town. What I'm trying to do there really is situate black town formation within a broader body of scholarship around black nationalism. We're trying to look at how the diversity of African-American responses to the United States and that experience of racial oppression. And one expression of that has been to seek greater autonomy. And we've generally talked about that in terms of black nationalism. And so what I basically try and argue is that the thrust toward black town formation, and you get something like 60 black towns built between 1890 and 1910, Brooklyn precedes that history, but this thrust is a response on the part of African Americans to create greater self-determination. So in Brooklyn, the kinds of things that I'm looking at is the type of cultural values that are being generated. I'm looking at whether or not politics play themselves out differently in an all-black town than in a biracial town. And I'm concerned about the relationship of this town as a corporate entity to the predominantly white towns that are in the county, as well as white corporations. So I'm looking at, in effect, how a kind of intertwining of capitalism and racism moves to stunt the economic and political development of this community, and how African Americans respond to that in very creative ways. But ultimately, we have to say that they were surrounded and overwhelmed by a process, though they fought violently.
These are the communities in the 1890 to 1910. So there are 50 or 60?
About 60, just in Oklahoma alone.
In Oklahoma alone?
We're dealing with a response on the part of African Americans to the nadir. You know, the thing about the 1890s that we really have to grasp is that in that decade, every 2.5 days, a black man, woman, or child was lynched. 1/3 of all the lynchings took place in the period from 1890 to 1899. So when you put it in that framework, you see massive waves of African Americans leaving the South, seeking to go west. They call it the Great Black March West, and that results in black town formation. But it's part of a larger political project. Edward McCabe had argued very forcefully that if African Americans could strategically locate themselves in Oklahoma territory, that then when the vote came for statehood, they would dominate the vote. Thus, they would be able to create a black government in Oklahoma, and they could, in effect, accomplish what the Mormons had accomplished, right? Mm. So the goal had it's for greater autonomy. It's not complete national separation, but it is for greater autonomy and self-control. And if you think about the African-American experience, certainly a dominant thrust of our response would be for greater autonomy and the ability to control our destiny.
Now, this is getting us off track here on Media Matters today, but I hope our listeners will bear with the personal interests of the host today. In the case of Oklahoma, there's a large Native American population there. What was the nature of the relations between the African American and Native Americans?
Well, like all relationships, it's mixed. But think of it in broad sense. A number of the Native American nations who were moved out of the East contain African American membership. Mm-hmm. Right, so you've got that part. Then you also have blacks coming in to acquire the land in much the same way that a quote-unquote white, largely immigrant population is coming in to acquire the land. So you're going to have levels of friction there. You've got some Indian tribes that previously owned blacks. But you're also going to have a sense in which Native Americans and African Americans are treated in very similar ways by the whites. So you see some joining together. Mm-hmm. You see some instances where some Native Americans begin to think of themselves as black because they've situated themselves in black communities. Some blacks begin to think of themselves as Native. So it's a mixed kind of bag, but on the whole, I would argue that it's fraught with more contradiction than collaboration and cooperation.
We're talking to David Roediger and Sindhiata Cha-Jua today. Cha-Jua. Excuse me. Thank you for getting that right. Two professors at the University of Illinois are joining us in the studio today for Media Matters. This is a pre-recorded show, so please don't call in. Just sit back and let the professionals do the talking today. We're talking about a number of issues concerning race in the media. And I think before we get into the media anymore, I'd like to turn the discussion, if I could, to the recent invasion of Iraq and current occupation of Iraq by the United States. One of the striking aspects of that story, of that incident in the United States, has been the way opposition to that war broke down along racial lines. I mean, it's really quite extraordinary. Dave, you've written about that, haven't you, or talked about it?
Yes, I've been trying to talk about it.
Well, here's your chance to talk some more about it. What do you have to say about it?
Well, I think one of the questions we need to begin to ask ourselves is how is it that anti-war opinion diverged so much according to race? About 2 weeks into the war, at least one set of polls showed 20% of white Americans in continuing opposition, way down from what it had been, to the war, and 68% of African Americans in opposition. I've really only
2 weeks into the war.
2 weeks into the war.
68%.
And I've really only heard right-wing commentators get interested in this. O'Reilly talks about it as kind of an index of how out of touch the black community is. But I think as a political question, it's a really important question how this develops, especially since, you know, at many anti-war demonstrations, the proportions were nothing like that. These were overwhelmingly white demonstrations, but apparently, you know, white demonstrators convinced very few people in their communities to join them in opposition to the war. And we, I think, ought to inquire into how is it, where does black anti-war opinion come from? What are mm-hmm. the sources? But I think it also has a media angle, because part of our explanation for why white support for the war so increased once the war started is, well, there was propagandistic media. And the media is not that different, or maybe it is, for African Americans. But at least we need to pose the question of, is there a different media experience and attitude toward the media that leaves some populations less willing to buy into?
That's a great way to, and the attitude towards the media is right, because maybe you're consuming much the same media, at least in terms of news, but just your response to it is more critical or more skeptical of what you're being told.
Right.
Sunyata, what's your take on it?
You know, I think that there's another piece in that. Black newspapers have a much wider range of political opinion than white dailies, so that you could open up in a small town, a black newspaper, and you're going to have major black leftists alongside liberals, moderates, and conservatives. So I think that the leftist voice, the black nationalist voice, has a lot to do with this. But there's also the fact that our experience is such that you begin with real skepticism when ever America says that they're going someplace to bring democracy, to bring development. We understand very clearly what that meant for us, right, and what that's meant for people of African descent. So you start with a kind of healthier skepticism.
You know, one of the things that's striking about this, too, is that with regard to the white population, but I think it's used to talk about the entire population, the argument goes that, well, you know, the opposition are these sort of middle-class kids, but working-class people whose kids are all doing the fighting, they're the ones who line up. They heckle war protesters. You know, the working-class people, you know, when they see war protesters, you know, yell obscenities and say, how can you oppose the war? Our kids are over there fighting this war. And that's sort of the classic line that's been used in recent years to say that this is sort of a pampered group of people who protest wars, who don't actually do the fighting, aren't sufficiently patriotic. Yet, this is a case with African Americans who are disproportionately the soldiers in these wars. I mean, way above the average. So by that logic, these should be the most gung-ho, super-nationalist people on earth. I mean, they should be out stringing people up from flagpoles. They'd be so upset with protests.
You know, you also got to add in the class dimension here that African Americans are overwhelmingly a working-class people. So that seems to refute that notion on both race and class terms.
Exactly.
You know, I think African Americans strongly opposed the war, overwhelmingly, as Dave said, but have not been, either there hasn't been real attempts to mobilize a kind of opposition that would come out on a corner, right, of a street and protest. Most of African American protest occurs inside its own institutions, and it's a kind of internal discourse in that sense. So while I'm not sure about the possibility of putting African Americans into the streets, around his anti-war approach, because we do understand the history of counterintelligence programs and the kind of repercussions. And it's clear that the Bush administration has taken a turn toward a real repressive, fascistic type of approach to dissent. So I don't think you'll get African Americans flooding the streets, but you will continue to see inside its own infrastructures, its own institutional bases, a constant move toward greater and greater criticism of this administration and its foreign policy, as well as its domestic policy.
I think that's true of working class people in general. Also, the height of the Vietnam protests, working class people were much more against the war statistically than middle class people, including college students. Income predicted support for the war. The higher the income, the higher the incidence of support for the war.
So that sort of urban legend I was pontificating isn't based in fact.
Right. But maybe in the demonstrations, there was something true mm-hmm. about that. And so I think we need to think very carefully about how, as movements, we deal with that set of realities, a large body of anti-war opinion that's not mobilizable, and a mobilizable body that's not very capable of shifting opinion. Mm-hmm. How did those two things come together?
How do you think they did? This seems to get really to the nub of the matter. What causes it? What can be done about it? And while you're pondering that, to give you a second to think, I was talking a few weeks ago, actually a while ago now, it was in April. I was in Chicago, and I had an opportunity to talk with the journalist Salim Muwakkil. He used to be a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. And he was organizing a group of African Americans in Chicago opposed to the war. And he said that they had a demonstration in the south side of Chicago with 2,500 people during the height of the war. I mean, so there were people coming out to demonstrate, but it was a different
different public space.
It's a different public space. It wasn't together. It wasn't marching arm in arm, but different communities operating separately.
So I think it was Salim's columns that actually set me to thinking about this, and, mm-hmm. and the figures come from his work in these times. One of the things I think it's important for white anti-war activists to not agonize about, well, why is it that at our picket on Prospect, the crowd is 5% African American, but everybody who honks in support is African American? I mean, I think the question has to be instead, what are the bases of African American anti-war opinion? Mm-hmm. When Aaron Magruder was here, the cartoonist who does Boondocks, Afro brought him in for the Du Bois.
And actually, I think it was brought in by Martin Luther King Committee.
The King Committee. Mm-hmm. And he talked a lot about kind of outmoded ways of protest and about and people reacted against it because he was saying, well, the King model, the kind of black and white together in the streets, may not be the only way to proceed. And at the time, my reaction was to say, no, we have to just do it more and we have to do it better. But as I think about these kinds of figures and polling data, I think maybe that there's something to that, that we do need to have some really basic conversations about how to build these movements.
Mm-hmm. Cindiana, do you want to, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I would just say that one of the striking things about this particular moment in history is that if we're talking about segregation, and I'm meaning this on two levels, on the one hand, segregation is white supremacy and its ability of whites to dictate other people's life and lifestyles. But it's also that point of separation, right? We have returned to the levels of the 1960s so that there's very little interaction between blacks and whites today. We had a moment in the late 70s where there was probably much greater interaction, but we've returned to something that approximates the early 1960s. So it would be ludicrous for us to think in terms of people who don't interact on a daily, everyday basis, that they would then come together to form political movements. That's not the way that's going to unfold. There's got to be another piece, and I'm not sure how that mm-hmm. other piece mm-hmm. comes together. You know, I do think universities have a role to play, because I think it's only in places like African American studies classes, really, that you have a large enough contingent of white and black and other racial minorities in the same space talking about something seriously. There's no other space in American society to promote that kind of exchange. So the university does, I do think students will play a role in creating that kind of, creating a space where different groups can come together around these kinds of issues. It's not going to emerge out of the communities.
You know, I've noticed the same phenomenon both in my personal life and just observing the world around me, that there's been there's an increase in segregation in this country since the 70s. And I have my own theories about that, which I won't bore anyone with right now, but I'd be interested in knowing your theories about, I'm sure you've given it some thought. Why do you think that's taken place? Dave can bat first on this one. Okay.
Well, I think part of it is the failure to build integrated communities. I mean, I think that just never happened, and we probably, many of us, believed that would happen, that some level of housing integration would take place, and it just hasn't happened. And now, even as you get black suburbanization, you still don't get significant.
You have black suburbs.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
And the one area where the state has really, at least in some cities, decisively contributed to the sharing of space across racial lines is schools. But those schools have been able to track and to essentially create situations in which you have an integrated school and a segregated school day. Both our kids went to St. Paul schools in Minnesota, which were 47% white, and their classes were 95% white. And I think that's a very – and I think in that situation –
I think we see that locally in the schools here too, from my experience.
Yeah. I think it's a situation in which people begin to become very cynical about integration. And there's no significant social movement that's speaking on behalf of integration. It's only talked about as an attitude or as a value. And so I think it's an uphill battle to get those kinds of contacts going.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think structurally we are talking about capitalism and a philosophy of privatism, and that without a movement on the part of the federal government specifically to reconfigure the way in which they did housing policy, one, affordable housing, right, but also to really push the Fair Housing Act of 1968. And when those things kind of fall by the wayside, and we know that the schools, to a great extent, mirror neighborhood, mirror the residential degree of integration. So I think there's that structural component. I also think that there's a philosophical aspect here in that integration has always meant virtually the same thing that segregation has meant, white control. And black people react very strongly to that. So I would say that...
So it's not really integration.
It's not really integration.
Black accommodation to white...
It's sprinkling of blacks within a white milieu where all the real decisions have already been decided. I think Patricia Williams, a law professor, gave a brilliant example about a so-called integrated school, and they had to decide around prom. And so what they decided is that, we'll vote on the band. Well, I think black students were 35%, white students were about 60%. And so naturally they end up choosing a rock band. So African Americans at that point say, well, look, you know, this third year in a row for this kind of thing, we will have our own prom, and we'll have some R&B, some hip-hop. And so I think that to some degree it's that kind of response, it's that combination of things.
Yeah, we're talking today to David Roediger and Sundiata Chajua. My guest today on Media Matters, I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded episode of Media Matters. We got our guest in the studio here in Campbell Hall. So please don't try to call in. Just sit back and relax and enjoy the program as much as you can. I'm enjoying it. Let's talk a little bit, if we could now, Dave and Sundiata, about sports, something that all three of us have an interest in, I think, intellectually and socially. And specifically, I mean, Dave, you've written in the Public Eye, was it?
Yes.
Recently, about sort of the deaf ear, you call it, that the left media have for sports. What did you mean by that?
Well, if you go back even to the early 20th century, many of the great sports writers in the United States were on the left. And I think that probably still sports writers are left of most editorial journalists. If you watch sports reporters on ESPN, you'll hear things that you would never hear on CNN. But there's certainly no conscious left presence in commenting on sports. And if you look at the left media, I was asked once to do a sports column for The Nation, and we just couldn't agree on even what it would be. I mean, I wanted to go to games, and they wanted muckraking, you know, completely. And I think it's a whole dimension of U.S. life, very, very much a dimension in which race is central, that there's really not much being said on the left about this. And what I tried to write in Public Eye was that what you then get instead is a very close nexus of sports and right-wing politics, and particularly...
So it's conceded to the right. It
right.
There. They get to define it and play with it.
Yeah, and particularly right-wing politics that dovetails with right-wing talk radio. So you have we have in town, the dominant radio station carries the sports of the Illinois team, and Rush Limbaugh, and local right-wing commentary owned by the same people as the newspaper. They read the newspaper on the air. There's this kind of nexus in which you develop this audience that's very empowered to call in and say, black athletes are this way, and then 2 hours later say, black people are this way. And then also, I was trying to get at where pro-chief sentiment comes from, and I think that's a very tightly woven media nexus that produces that kind of a result. I grew up in St. Louis, which invented, at least claims to have invented, talk radio at KMOX, very much a right-wing project in the 1960s, and it's where Limbaugh also grew up, just south of St. Louis. And I think there, and then with his forays into trying to be a sports,
trying to be on Monday Night Football,
I think there's this very, very interesting relationship.
And then Dennis Miller moved to the right once he got there, it sounds like.
Right. So anyway, just wanted to raise those issues and to wonder why we don't really talk about sports.
So, Ned, have you given it some thought?
Not really. I mean, there's certain things that seem fairly obvious that there is a kind of conceit on the part of the left towards sports. And as Dave said, the emphasis is to look for muckraking and not to appreciate, the elegance of the athletic competition, those kinds of things. And in the African-American community, clearly liberal and left activists tried to pose a contradiction between sports participation and academic success, and that's obviously the wrong way to broach those matters, but I've not tried to explore that deeply.
You know, one of the things that, now I came of age in the late 60s and early 70s, and one of the striking things as I was growing up about athletics and politics that really jumped out was the degree to which leading black athletes in that period, the pioneers, many of them really came out and took very controversial political positions. I mean, really, in retrospect, we all know about Muhammad Ali, but it goes well beyond that, across the board. Really courageous positions. And one of the laments you see of older, retired black athletes today and activists from that generation is, you know, here we have this generation of a very talented, articulate, intelligent, sensitive people who are making a lot of money in the public eye, but they're not willing to do what their predecessors had done in the 1950s and 60s and even into the 70s and stand out on important issues of labor, of apartheid, right up and down the list, social justice. Is this something you've wrestled with at all or thought about, given any thought to?
But I want to add something that I think is equally important with, just speaking out about social issues of the day, is the role that black athletes have played in terms of the unionization of professional sports, particularly fighting for things like free agency and those aspects. That those are major contributions.
Yeah, well, Curt Flood certainly in the case of baseball, and then in the case of football, Gene Upshaw being the president of the Players Union now for about 15 years, roughly.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, I think it's back to this whole thing of commercialization that let's take the case of LeBron James. Nike signed him to a contract for, $100 million, $10 million signing bonus, $90 million, so that the bulk of his money, whatever his basketball salary is, you know, and whatever it becomes.
I got to interrupt you. This is NPR. LeBron James is a high school basketball player. He's going to be the first pick in the – who was perhaps at this point the first pick in the NBA draft from Akron, Ohio. It's considered the finest high school basketball player maybe in history, but certainly in a generation or two.
Okay. So whatever he makes in terms of his NBA salary, not just his rookie salary, but throughout his career, right? Because the max he could ever make as an NBA player would be a seven-year contract for about $98 million. He's always going to make more from Nike and his other endorsements. That means that athletes become very sensitive to their image because they're marketing themselves as opposed to playing the game for one corporation, which they then have a power relationship, right? They do have greater power with that owner because of their role of the team. That now in this broader world of trying to market themselves, they tend to step back.
That's
and be
really
afraid of alienation. You know, Michael Jordan's comment. I want to get this in.
Yeah, please.
Probably because I'm an anti-Jordan guy.
Because you're a Knicks fan.
Well,
the truth is out.
That's the truth. But
even now,
it's also Jordan's politics. Right. When Jordan was asked why he didn't support Harvey Gantt, his response
when
was
Gantt
absolutely classic. Well, yeah, when Gantt ran for Senate in North Carolina, Jordan said Republicans buy shoes too.
So he didn't want to antagonize them.
That's right.
And as you make that point, what strikes me is that there are still the public figures that, who probably are most well-known for taking political and controversial statements, if not athletes anymore, are entertainers, actors, and musicians. And that reminds me of the case we're currently seeing with Danny Glover, who's
yes.
been outspoken on the death penalty and the war and has been hired to be the MCI spokesperson in their television ads. And there's been a sustained campaign at MCI to get him fired from doing the ads because of the political position he's taking. And to the extent athletes and entertainers depend on this as a key part of their livelihood, it's a strong pressure on them to do exactly what Michael
Absolutely.
Jordan has done. Yeah. What are your thoughts on this, Dave? You're a historian.
I actually wrote about this a little
okay.
bit.
Well,
in
the, enlighten
when Toni Morrison did her book on the Simpson case, Leola Johnson and I did an article together for that book on O.J. Simpson as the first black athlete to cross over to mm-hmm. huge marketing mm-hmm. success. And before he signed his first contract, exactly like LeBron, he was already making more in endorsements. And this was a time when Bill Russell couldn't get any endorsements.
1969.
Bob Gibson couldn't get any endorsements. No other black athletes were getting endorsements.
Jim Brown wasn't.
But Simpson denounced the 68 Olympic protest, and he was a track star at the time as well as a football player.
Did he compete in the Mexico City Olympics? Because
no.
I knew he was on the NCAA champion 4x100
right.
relay team.
But he didn't compete,
okay.
and I think it had to do with football.
It was football
But he did
that,
denounce the protesters. And he was very much, you know, had his picture taken with John Wayne all the time, going to USC. He was around movie stars, but right-wing. Movie stars. And so he very quickly developed this new model black athlete
right.
that was dependent on endorsements and supposedly, and this is what the article ends up being about, transcended race.
Mm-hmm.
So he says that people look at O.J. the man, they never look at O.J. The color. There's an irony in that because then he's back to seeing the world, and his case is another one of these examples where there's this wild divergence of mm-hmm. opinion across the color line. But he really was the kind of pilot project to mm-hmm. develop this, and he backs up from union commitments because he very much wants out of doesn't want to play for Buffalo. He wants to try to play in Southern California, and it would have behooved him to fight with the union harder. But he's bought by that point.
So today, are there athletes? And, you know, I think also when we talk about this, it's unfair. African-American athletes are sort of held to the standard. They're
right.
supposed to be the ones who are social consciousness, whereas, you know, other athletes, be they white or Latino or Asian-American or whatever their nationality, aren't held to the standard. They, you know, they're allowed to just be selfish and take care of number
right.
one. In fairness to, there were a number of white athletes and non-African-American athletes in the 60s who were also outspoken. It wasn't simply African-American athletes who were out in the front. I remember the great book by Dave Magasey. I don't know if you've ever read it. You're from St. Louis.
Yeah.
You should know Magasey.
Yeah.
The great expose of those Cardinal football teams in the 60s, which, you know, were just quite extraordinary. We're talking today on Media Matters, and it seems to be becoming a private conversation about sports with David Roediger and Cindy Adachajua. We're talking about media and race and other matters. This is a pre-recorded show, so please don't try to call in. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Let's turn exactly to one of the fundamental issues in media studies, which is the way African-Americans, minorities, are presented in the media, what the biases are, what the patterns are for presentation. Cindy, I know this is an issue that we were talking about before the show. I mean, the general consensus, and I don't mean by scholars, but I'd say in public opinion, is, okay, back in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, we had real problem. There were blatantly racist images of African-Americans. You had Aunt Jemima and Step and Fetch It, and you had, African-Americans never got lead roles. They always had to play menial parts. Talented African-Americans couldn't even get through the door to do films or have successful careers. But that's all changed now. We've got the Civil Rights Act. Talented African-Americans can rise to the top if they're gifted in Hollywood. Programs also have now a much more enlightened show. We have shows like The Cosbys in the 80s, which showed that programs about African-Americans can be successful and cross over and reach a general public. Those problems are behind us. We might have problems with race in our society, but thank God in the media we don't have those problems anymore. I think that's if you were to talk to a lot of people, that would be the general sense that many people, not most, but many people might have. What would you say to someone who says that?
I would say, how does one explain the fact that a fairly moderate, although the oldest civil rights organization, NAACP, has been threatening Hollywood with a boycott every year for the last 3 years. And it has to do with the exclusion of images, right? And there was a move to kind of address this exclusion of black images on primetime, the major networks. And the way that that's been addressed is very interesting when you compare it to the way it was addressed when the protests were made in the 60s and 70s. In the 60s and 70s, what was generated was a series of African-American-oriented television shows, mainly sitcoms. Many of them were bad, but some of them were fairly good. The way it's been addressed
this
time...
What were the good ones?
That's a Sanford and Son.
Yeah, that was good, definitely.
We're on a... I overspoke. Yeah. Most of them were horrible. Let me correct myself.
Yeah, I don't know what I should be watching on late night television.
Yeah. But you look at the way it's been addressed in this moment, right? And the way it's been addressed is not to do African-American-oriented shows such as Cosby, such as Frank's Place, but to, in fact, sprinkle black characters into white stories, but only those sitcoms and dramas that are workplace-based, right?
Mm-hmm.
Never appear in those sitcoms and dramas that are more about home life and the workplace-based one. And they're always middle-class, black, buffy types. And while clearly that range needs to be there, but the bulk of the African-American community is a working-class community where people work in stable jobs, live a decent life, try and get an education for their kids. That aspect is never shown. The aspect of black institutional life, be it churches, be it community organizations, those kinds of things are completely outside the purview of the major networks. And then there is this continuation of hardcore, nasty, old-fashioned racist images. And I only have to say three words, Jar Jar Binks.
Mm-hmm. Well, for our listeners, explain that, because I have some of that not going to register.
Okay, Star Wars, they created a character that they called Jar Jar Binks. And the guy developed his language through using a Jamaican patois with African-American Ebonics. And then, while the actor doesn't say this, but you can find a clip of an old Step and Fetch It film, and you can see it in Ethnic Notions, which is a critique of African-American images in the media. And you can see this, there's a scene where Step and Fetch It is walking with his shoes around his neck, and he's doing that kind of old Negro Sambo kind of walk, shuffle. And you see in Star Wars, Jar Jar Binks has adopted that form of motion.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost, you could put the images side by side, same kind of voice technique, mm-hmm. To the max.
Okay.
And then you think about it, in Star Wars, this highly technological, futuristic film, the people who are the characters that are presented as black fight with spears.
Well, how much of this do you think, Dave, is just the class bias to some extent? Not the explicit use of racist imagery there, but the fact that working class whites aren't really shown on television either. I mean, it's basically, if you're going to do a show about upper middle class people, which most shows are about, even working class people live in houses that are almost unaffordable except to, right, you know, millionaires. Then an honest show isn't going to show much interracial. You wouldn't have a black character in the home life, maybe at the work life. And how much if it's a show about a bunch of rich surgeons, it's going to be about white people. But working class whites are pretty much written out of script, and they too are presented largely as knucklehead morons when they're presented just like working class blacks. I mean, it's a class bias built in here.
There's been an interesting controversy lately that you perhaps followed on your show about the plans CBS to do a new Beverly Hillbillies. It's a reality-based Beverly Hillbillies.
I love that term, reality-based.
Yeah, reality, as they say.
Yeah.
An interesting configuration of forces have come to oppose that, largely union-led and led by
the mine workers.
Cecil Roberts
and the
mine workers. And I think that, you know, that is an example of the fact that we just really don't see working class people on TV. But I think it's important to realize that we don't live in the 1920s and 1930s anymore. That obviously some kind of progress has been made. But I don't know that there's been progress made since the 1970s on these issues. I still watch Rockford Files religiously in rerun. And there are these fabulous black and Latino characters on Rockford Files. Now, that the way that they get in is a common prison experience, but it's not at work. It's in real life that Lou Gossett and Isaac Hayes appear consistently in the Rockford Files. And yet we can have Friends go on for X number of seasons as, you know, what might be called white friends.
No, I think, you know, that this gets, again, a little bit off track, but I think the 70s discussion is very interesting, the changes that goes back to the points you were making earlier. You see shows like Barney Miller, for example, or to make the most ludicrous example, I recently saw, and it just my mouth fell open, one of the all-time bad shows in television history, Three's Company.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no disagreement there. But they had a program once about this guy who was sort of like sleeping out on the bench, and he was a real jerk. No one liked him. He's this old, crusty guy, and he's really rude. And he was sleeping on a bench, and they brought him in and said, "This is outrageous. No one should ever be allowed to sleep on a bench in America." I mean, this is like made in the 70s. And I'm watching it in the 80s, and I mean, whoa, you know, times have changed. You know, because they take someone they hated, none of them like it, but they couldn't, it was just offensive to let someone sleep outside and not have a place to sleep. Yeah. And it really gives a sense that we're in a very different age. You know, one of the issues that concerns a lot of people, that they say one of the explanations for why you have a paucity of decent African-American characters in Hollywood and in television shows, there's a number of reasons. One is the lack of African-American owners owning media. So there's not going to be a built-in sympathy to the project. Now, African-American owners obviously aren't going to be working-class people, but at least they're going to come from a community, often have connections, so this would be something that would resonate more. How much of an issue do you think that might be?
I think that it's probably somewhat of an issue, but I would imagine that the lack of African-American production companies as opposed to television networks is a little bit more critical there.
Mm-hmm.
This question about coming from the community, I think that in the 60s, That would have been the case, but we're now at a moment where people who often become black millionaires have been alienated from the core institutions of the black community for some time. So it's a different group of black moneyed people today than, say, 60s and 70s. So I think that's part of it. I think the major question is around community access to media as opposed to black ownership. I think black ownership is one piece of it, but it's the ability of a community to have themselves represented and to have a role in the decision-making uh, of, about the range of characterizations. You know, obviously this works better when talking about a local radio station, right, than it does in talking about a major media conglomerate like a national broadcast system. But clearly that's a kind of tension there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd fall on the side of access, control of production companies, writers who are able to get the stuff on, rather than just focusing on this narrow strip of ownership. Because the reality is that less than 2% of the media are owned by all minorities, including white women.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not going to have much movement on that front. And given that nowadays the media is, we're talking transnational capital, mega mergers, right?
Mm-hmm.
ESPN is owned by ABC.
Owned by Disney.
Owned by Disney.
Yeah.
You know, so at the end of the day, maybe Robert Johnson, you know, BET will become a major network. But
well, he sold to Viacom.
Right. He's been bought out by Viacom.
Yeah. So
although he remains the chief operating officer, I think, for BET.
Oh, okay.
But the bottom line is that that's not what we're going to see in the future.
That's not the panacea.
That's not the panacea. It can happen in the recording industry. It's not happening in television. It's too much money involved. So we got to approach that with a more diverse set of issues and demands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how about in the case of journalism specifically? Here is also a very important issue concerning the matter of how race is covered, racial politics. David, you've been writing about this historically. I've been covering it for hundreds or 200 years in American history. If you could generalize, how would you say the way mainstream journalism in the United States has covered questions of race has changed in the last 30 or 40 years, and has it changed for the better?
Well, I think it's made an enormous difference that we now do have a body of black reporters and editorial writers. And I think about somebody like Salim, who though was kind of easily elbowed aside by the Tribune at a certain point, but Herbert at the Times and even Clarence Page at certain moments will say things that are completely Derek Jackson, that are completely not found Malvo, you know, there are all of these voices that appear in the black press, but appear in USA Today,
in a number of
venues, and are beginning to find their way as oppositional voices onto CNN and some other venues as well. So I think that, you know, I think about that voice when I was growing up as being Karl Rowan, who was clearly so constricted in what he could say, and had been in and out of government in very constrained positions. I think things have changed in that regard.
Well, you know, there's a great book, or a good book at least, that came out a few years ago. I think it was called Why Americans Hate Welfare, by Gillens. Did either of you see that?
Yeah.
And it was an interesting argument, because if you aren't familiar with this, Sindhati, I think you'd be interested in it. And the argument, he tried to, why do people hate welfare? Now, what is it that accounts for why this program is so universally disliked by Americans, apparently? And correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, you've read it, because it's been a few years since I read it. But as I recall, his argument was that when welfare was presented as a program that was universally used, it went especially to white people. It was seen as fairly popular, and when it was presented as basically a program for African Americans, it was seen as like totally unacceptable transfer of resources from hardworking people to people who didn't deserve it, and that his argument was almost entirely race based. And he would look at the coverage, and you could see the coverage when it was favorable invariably showed hardworking white people down on their luck. And when it was like a critical piece, it was invariably a black person in the picture, and like, you know, this person doesn't deserve it, or not one of us. And his argument was that the problem, in his assessment, Gillens, the problem here was one basically of who the journalists were. The newsroom being overwhelmingly white, to say people who fell into racist patterns or racial patterns of categorization naturally, it was uncritically, and really just were just sort of incapable of standing outside that and sort of saying, wait a second, what's going on here?
There's a really good example that gets us back to sports, and that's Midnight Basketball, which Doug Hartman has studied at University of Minnesota. When the Republicans decided to oppose money for Midnight Basketball, or really social spending connected to Clinton's support for the hideous crime bill that was being passed, when they decided to oppose that, they seized on midnight basketball. The press had portrayed midnight basketball until that point as a Republican, which it was, project that Jack Kemp invented to kind of use sport to inculcate good values. Immediately, that coverage changed. And I think Doug found something like 100 photographs accompanying midnight basketball stories. And he, all but one were black kids with bandanas on their heads. Or, you know, and the one that was a white basketball player was in the Amsterdam News as a send-up of all of the others.
African-American newspaper.
Yeah. Right, so, yeah. I think that in that case, I almost don't know if it's just this internalized whiteness that makes the reporters not see things, or if it also is kind of subject to racist manipulation in a certain way. This looks like a concerted campaign.
And also, I mean, for most of our journalism today, I think it's pitched increasingly on class lines. Certainly, it's aimed at the middle and upper middle class. So their vision of their readership is a white readership, probably an upper middle class, middle class readership. They're not envisioning writing for an African American or even working class audience. So you'll naturally maybe interpret it in such a way then that recreates these racist images and stereotypes and biases
There might be an aspect of that that is correct. I mean, when I think back to moments of recession, and I know that when the recession of 79 hit, a lot of people I knew, black working class people, the first thing that they cut out their budget was the local newspaper. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the images that are more devastating is not what's coming out of the writing of journalists in local papers, but it's what's being aired on television. It's what's, and it's, you know, in talk radio, of course.
You know, we've just got about a minute left in the show. And before we go, I'd like to ask each of you to give me a sense of what media you consume to sort of stay on top of the world, to give you a sense of what's going on. We'll start with you, David. What's your diet look like?
Well, I read the kind of standard U.S. left press insofar as it exists anymore in these times, Progressive Nation, New Politics, Monthly Review. And that's very, very important to me. I also find myself, and I never thought I would, on the internet a lot and looking at various websites and being sent a lot of things off of the
internet. Any websites in particular jump out?
Because of my research, I very often read right-wing websites. I read Horowitz's website and then read out from there to the left that he's criticizing.
Cindy,
The same standard left press, but also a suite of African-American journals, the Black Scholar, especially Souls, and to some degree, Journal of Black Studies. But I also look at Black Commentator as a website. Really good.
Okay. I want to thank Dave Roediger and Cindy Adachajula for being my guests today. Join me next week at Media Matters.